Welcome to the Archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. President Bill Clinton's foreign policy was often scrutinized and challenged, beginning even prior to when he took office in January of 1993. After he took office, and during the international clamor of the mid-1990s, the election of 1996, the war in Bosnia, Boris Yeltsin losing strength in Russia, President Clinton's foreign policy came under even further scrutiny. My guest in this archive edition of Radio Curious is Dr. C.M. Brown, a professor of international relations at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. He's been a foreign policy analyst, advisor, and author for more than 40 years. In this program, originally broadcast in September of 1995 as the second of a two-part series, we begin by discussing President Clinton's policies in Haiti, Bosnia, and Korea.
I think it is unstructured in a number of ways. One is the formulation of the policy. He made it clear when he first came into office that he wanted to concentrate more on domestic policy, and this left it to his advisors, his foreign policy advisors, Warren Christopher, Secretary of State, Anthony Lake, the National Security Advisor, Les Aspin, who was then Secretary of Defense, then supplemented more recently by Secretary of Defense Perry. He made it clear that he was depending upon them to formulate the policy, and he trusted their judgment.
What are some of the problems that the United States runs into when the president relies on others to formulate a foreign policy?
Well, he doesn't give them sufficient guidance as to what he really prefers. He hasn't really thought this out. And since these are individuals with their own interests, with their own agendas, heading on the one hand the Defense Department, on the other hand the Department of State, and the National Security Advisor, also having his own view of things. Each of them is going to be competing against the other to get their view of what policy should be.
Well, when we don't have a clearly defined foreign policy in the United States, how does that affect the internal workings of the country? In other words, the average person.
Well, the average person obviously doesn't get a clear sense of what the policy is, because if you don't have a president who is able to simply define what the foreign policy goals are, what the national interests are that require citizens to maybe sacrifice some of their own income, maybe even risk having their sons and sometimes daughters go abroad in dangerous situations. If the president can't clearly define what the national interests are, what the threats to those interests are, then there's going to be very little public support for policy. And if the policy formulation is fragmented, where there are many voices making policy and saying what the policy is, which was the characteristic under Clinton, then he's going to have a very difficult time getting public support. He's going to have a very difficult time getting support out of the Congress.
Well, let's try and apply that to some current examples. Mm-hmm. There's Bosnia, there's Haiti, there's Korea. Mm-hmm. How do those or other examples fit into the problem of an unfocused foreign policy?
Let's look at Haiti for a minute. Clinton, when he was running for office, castigated Bush for his policy toward the Haitian refugees, the boat people. said it was, essentially, he said it was an immoral policy, and when he got in, he was going to change things.
And that was the policy of turning people back and sending them back to Haiti.
Turning people back, right. Okay. He gets into office, and in office, when he faces what it would mean to actually let them in, what it would mean is alienating the voters and the in Florida, and the a lot of the voters in Florida, and the political leaders in Florida, and in his own party, are very worried that he, in fact, is going to reverse the Bush policy and let a lot of the Haitians in. A lot of them they feared would be coming into Florida, and they would alienate the Cuban population of Florida that is very politically active. And so now Clinton, faced with the prospect of an important part of his electoral constituency getting very angry at him, decides he has to find another way. And so he says, we're not going to allow all of these people in, and what we're going to do is we're going to act on the conditions that have made them leave Haiti. We're going to see if we can bring democracy to Haiti. We'll bring Aristide back, who was elected and then thrown out in the military coup that was effected by Cedrus, by General Cedrus.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets much more committed now to reversing the situation in Haiti, and this he starts to define this, his advisors and so on, and he starts to define this as a national interest. Getting rid of Cedrus. And when they find that Cedrus is not going to budge, then they start threatening him. And the threat involves the threat eventually to use military force. Now he's got a lot of Americans who say, wait a minute, we don't want to have our sons going in there and risking their lives. What's the national interest? We don't have a vital national interest in Haiti. You mean to say, Mr. President, you're paying attention just to the Florida voters, and you're going to make this a national interest? And so he becomes uncertain as to what he wants to do. He starts threatening to use force. At the last moment, he calls in President Carter to see if there's some kind of a way out. And Carter finds a way out for him, so he doesn't have to use force. But meanwhile, the American people are very confused about it as to why he's reversing course in the first place against the Bush policy of keeping the refugees out. Okay.
Well, using that example and the other two examples of Bosnia and Korea that I'd like you to address, I would then be looking for an answer to the question is, why is this being brought about? Is it peculiar to Clinton, or is it peculiar to the state of foreign policy in the United States now? But before we get to that, maybe we could get some more foundation with the Korean example, for instance.
Well, the Korean example, I think, is less clear-cut as an example of the pressures working on Clinton. Again, he looked like he was flip-flopping in this. In the Korean case, the North Koreans indicated that they were going to go ahead with a project to develop their own nuclear weapons and said that they would leave the treaty, which is called the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that obligated them to refrain from building nuclear weapons. Well, when the Clinton administration focused on this, they believed that this would be intolerable for international security reasons. If the Koreans developed a nuclear weapons capability, perhaps then the Japanese would decide they have to go nuclear. And this is going to destabilize a whole lot of the post-World War II and post-Cold War relationships in Asia. So, and it was going to also open up a Pandora's box of a lot of countries who perhaps want to get nuclear weapons of their own, the Indians, the Pakistanis, maybe the Libyans, maybe the Iranians, and so on. Here now is a country defiantly saying, we're going to go ahead and we're going to acquire nuclear weapons of our own. The Clinton administration decides, and here there was unity among the advisors, that they couldn't allow this to happen. They have to prevent Korea from developing its own nuclear weapons. How do you do it? you probably have to threaten them with consequences to going ahead with their program. Mm-hmm. What consequences? There could be an economic boycott, but that's not going to do very much good when they really looked at it, because the United States was having very little trade with North Korea anyway.
Almost none. It wasn't.
Almost none.
Our passports didn't allow us to travel.
Right. Didn't recognize them even. So that wasn't going to work. And hints were then made by the Clinton administration that if in fact they go ahead and start developing their nuclear weapons, that the United States might have to engage in what they like to call a surgical strike. That is to knock out the nuclear weapons producing facilities mm-hmm. before they could really develop their nuclear weapons.
And how far, in your opinion, was our government from doing a surgical strike?
I think they were very close, but there was division within the government. There was division because some of the people, and particularly in the State Department, were telling Clinton, although we could do this, militarily it would be possible to do it, that if we really threatened to engage in a surgical strike against them, and they thought that we meant that they might decide to reopen the Korean War. The Korean War was over, as you know, was a very bloody war, was over in 1953, and that they had tremendous military superiority facing South Korea. And so they could pour across the dividing line between North and South Korea and face the United States with the need to fight another Korean-style war, which would be a Vietnam-style war. Mm-hmm. Now, when some people in the administration faced this prospect, they weren't so sure that they wanted to go through with a delivery on the threat. And not only that, even to make the threat in a very serious way might provoke the North Koreans to attack. So now there's a great deal of hair pulling in the Clinton administration as to what they should do about the situation.
And they come up with...
They call in Jimmy Carter.
Right.
I mean, this took place earlier than Haiti, when they called in Jimmy Carter. They called in Jimmy Carter, who has developed an expertise in conflict resolution. And Jimmy Carter travels to Pyongyang, North Korea. And he talks in a respectful way to the North Koreans and indicates that, look, none of us is going to benefit by this impasse that we have. And he works out at least a temporary agreement that the North Koreans won't go ahead with a nuclear weapons program in exchange for a pledge by the United States to help the North Koreans develop their peaceful nuclear program with all kinds of modern technologies and reactors and so on. Okay. So they back off from that. Now, the American people getting all of this from the press, first of all, are exposed to a very tough stance by the Clinton administration, saying we won't tolerate their defying us in this respect. And then they see the president not being able to handle this himself, but calling in the previous president, Jimmy Carter, who to a lot of the American people was a poor foreign policy president, who goes to North Korea and presents a solution to the problem. It doesn't look like there's leadership at the level of Clinton. He's getting somebody else to pull him out of a difficult situation.
When you say it doesn't look like there's leadership at the level of Clinton, is that your opinion, that there is no foreign policy leadership at Clinton's level?
Well, my opinion is that he could have pursued the policies that Carter was pursuing, but boxed himself into a corner of talking very tough and then finding it difficult to back off from that. So he calls in an intermediary to do the job for him. And in that sense, I think that he made himself, at the end, look rather weak. Now, I think what he did in calling in Carter was better than going ahead with the confrontation that could have led to a nuclear strike against North Korea and a reopening of the Korean War. So I think he did a good thing, and I think he exercised leadership at least to the extent...
within his ability.
Within his ability of pulling back from the brink, which he shouldn't have gotten the United States to in the first place. Okay. So, yeah, some leadership, but not enough, and too late to really be effective in developing a reputation not only with the American people, but with others in the world, that he knows what he's doing.
So if we take this situation then to Bosnia, that we're in the middle of the conflict, Jimmy Carter hasn't gone there yet as an envoy of the United States. What do you see?
Well, he did, actually. He went there once.
Without the success that he had.
Without a great success, but he got a temporary ceasefire.
Which is now long gone.
Now long gone, right, yeah.
So how do you characterize the Bosnian situation?
There, if we pick it up in the Clinton administration, a lot has already happened. The Bush administration handed the Clinton administration a deteriorating situation. It's not that the Bush administration created the situation in Bosnia, but they handed the Clinton administration a situation in which you have this terrible, brutal killing going on in Bosnia, and the United States president and his principal advisors under Bush having already said that this does not involve vital U.S. interests. And what they meant by that is whatever was going on in Bosnia, however brutal it was not worth Americans losing their lives over. Okay. Now, but the situation is terrible, as everybody knows who has, you know, read the newspapers and watched the news reports.
Well, it's on the level of genocide.
A level of genocide. And this is something that then the United Nations, at least if it was going to develop any capacity in the post-Cold War period, the United Nations should at least act. It should act to prevent genocide because of certain of the legacies of World War II and the treaty against genocide, and also because these conflicts between different ethnic groups killing one another after the Cold War, if you want any kind of world order that has any kind of a meaning, and there's an international organization, ought to be able to act in this case. Well, the United States went along in sponsoring various kinds of resolutions to create peacekeeping units to go out there, but with the proviso that the United States was not going to become involved itself on the ground. It wasn't going to put any of its forces there. What happens then is that the United States essentially stays out of any risk to itself, while the British and the French and the Dutch and then various other countries, third world countries and so on, are contributing peacekeeping units to police various kinds of ceasefires that are going on in Bosnia. The Bosnian themselves, the Serbs and the Croats and the Muslims, seeing that the United States is not really involved in this, apparently are encouraged to believe that the international community doesn't have sufficient strength to control what they're doing. And it's going to be settled on the ground, on the battlefield, on the ground.
Between the Bosnians and the Serbs.
Between the Bosnian Serbs, the Bosnian Muslims, and the Bosnian Croats, particularly for who's going to have more most territory in Bosnia. Well, U.S. diplomacy becomes active, but it's a diplomacy that is, without risk to itself, and this means without clout, while the Europeans are the ones that are there on the ground, putting their own forces in harm's way.
I want to ask you about the U.S. diplomacy becoming active, but before we do that, I want to take a moment and say that my guest this week is Dr. C.M. Brown, a professor of politics at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts, and we're talking about the current foreign policy of the Clinton administration. You're listening to Radio Curious, and my name is Barry Vogel. The U.S. foreign policy becoming active in Bosnia. What does this mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, the United States became one of those that was presenting all kinds of possible solutions to this terrible conflict in Bosnia, in which the ethnic groups were trying to create as much territorial control for each of themselves. The Bosnian Muslims wanted to keep control of the areas in which the Muslims were dominant. Mm-hmm. The Serbs wanted to obviously keep control in the areas in which they were dominant, and the Croats in areas in which they were dominant. The Bosnians, Bosnia being a part of Yugoslavia, the Bosnian Muslims wanted Bosnia to be an independent country and to have the Serbs and the Croats be part of the larger Bosnia. And the Serbs in particular said, no, we didn't want to be a part of a larger Bosnia. And if you can be independent, we can also be independent. We want to fight for our own self-determination. I'm simplifying a bit here, but that was the spark of what amounted to a civil war in Bosnia between the Bosnian Serbs and the Bosnian Croats, with the Serbs across the border in Serbia proper helping the Bosnian Serbs. Okay. Now, this is deteriorating, and most of the diplomats in the international community said that the only solution to this type of thing eventually is going to be some kind of a partition of the country, unfortunately.
And not done necessarily by the people who live there.
Well, some combination of it done by the... Hopefully they will agree to it, but this will have to be enforced by the external community.
Well, let's go back to what I was asking earlier about is this problem of U.S. foreign policy being unfocused unique to Bill Clinton, or is it more unique to the times of the United States now?
Mm-hmm. I think it's more unique. It's more a product of the times. And there always have been periods when U.S. foreign policy might have seemed to be confused, but it seems, I think, particularly confused now. Because after the Cold War, the United States does not have a clear enemy. It doesn't have a clear definition of the threats to its basic well-being and security. And as Haiti exhibited, the president had difficulty in defining what was the U.S. national interest in Haiti. And during the Cold War, he probably would have pointed to either the fact or the allegation that Marxists would take over in Haiti if it became too unstable. During the Cold War, the North Koreans could be regarded as part of the Sino-Soviet threat, the communist threat in Asia. And then there would be no question that the United States could take decisive military action against them. In Bosnia, part of what used to be Yugoslavia, instability there could be capitalized upon by the Russians, by the Soviets. And that would bring the Soviets into a very crucial strategic area right up against the Mediterranean, which they didn't have bases there before. Mm-hmm. And so the United States would find it easy to define this as a threat to U.S. national interests. It was required major sacrifice. That's not available anymore.
But if we had a president who had a very clear and spoken foreign policy, would it make a difference, considering the historical times that we are in now in the post-Cold War?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The if is a big one, because the question is whether or not any individual could define foreign policy in a clear enough way, what the U.S. interests are and what the threats to those interests are, to fulfill this picture of a president that would have a clear enough foreign policy. Now, I think Clinton has confused things more than he needs to, because of his weak leadership, his unwillingness to make foreign policy something that he really takes a direct interest in, his delegating it to his subordinates. It looks even more confused than it had to be. I think fundamentally, though, any president, if Bush got reelected president, I think it would be at least as confused. I think Dole has the luxury of sounding like he's decisive. That's because in the opposition, you can always sound decisive in the opposition.
Mm-hmm. Just as Clinton did 3.5 years
ago. That's right, yeah. But once he got into power, then the complexities of the situation face him.
Right.
And I think the confusion is inherent, that the contradictions and therefore confusions in defining U.S. interest are inherent in the situation.
Well, Professor Brown, I want to thank you for joining us here in Radio Curious. But before we go, I want to ask you the question I like to ask all guests at the end of an interview, and that is, could you recommend an interesting book to our listeners, either on this topic or some other topic that you find intriguing?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I think the most interesting book on this is the book that I wrote.
Tell
which
us.
Is called The Faces of Power, Constancy and Change in U.S. Foreign Policy from Truman to Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And who published that?
Columbia University Press. I have found in reading it lately that I'm informed each time I read the book about these issues.
Well, Dr. Brown, thank you very much for joining us here on Radio Curious.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be with you, Barry.
Dr. C.M. Brown is a professor of international relations at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. The book he recommends is The Faces of Power, Constancy and Change in U.S. Foreign Policy from Truman to Clinton. That book is written by Professor Brown. His first name is spelled S-E-Y-O-M and pronounced Seam. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.